It hits with the gut shock of a knockout punch. A picture as brazen as the naked bulbs of Broadway and as hard as the New York streets where it was shot.
Can't you get it, Vinny? To me, you're just an old man. You smell bad.
I could kill you right here and now.
Oh, I don't think you will.
All right, welcome to Orphan Radio. This is Matt. Today, my guest is David Curcio. He has a new book out called Smash Hit, Race, Crime, and Culture in Boxing Films. And it's a great read. You should definitely check it out. He's going to talk about the book today and some other subjects. So, David, before we get into the actual book, what's your background in writing about boxing and film? How did this come together?
Well, it's funny. I would say I did a few pieces on writing about the subjects together for a publication, Ringside Seat Magazine. And from there, I think the germination of the idea for the book, the format, began to take form at that point. And from there, I've also had a column that's structured like a dialogue on the website The Fight City with another boxing writer named Andrew Rein. And, you know, that has also served as a sort of sounding board, an impetus to research the some of the films discussed. But honestly, you know, I've always been a film buff. I became interested in boxing about 10 years ago, but what I really felt was particularly interesting. I mean, I'm far from encyclopedic in my knowledge. As they say, I know what I know. I really enjoy reading particularly biographies and broader histories of the sport. And the way they reflect, the way these stories, these lives, these significant fights, rivalries, whatever, come to sort of represent political or social moments.
So when you started writing the book, how did you put it all together? Did you, I know it's 20 different chapters about 20 different films and kind of how they reflect what the time, you know, what the times say about the culture at the moment. So how did the original idea come together as far as like linking those two? And I know it kind of all goes back to the beginning of like motion pictures, right?
The inception of film under, you know, initially under Thomas Edison began to conceive of the idea of the moving picture. He quickly lost interest when he realized that he could not incorporate sound, which was a technology that wouldn't come to fruition for another 35 years. But he passed the project on to his assistant. And from there, you know, they ran with soundless film, which started out, you know, in pretty primitive formats. You know, if 1891 was when the most primitive film format, which was private viewing, was unveiled, 6 years later, by that point, the capability for projection came about. It's really coincidence. This came at a time when boxing under its new, what we'll call civilizing rules, which is essentially the replacement of the bare knuckle fighting.
Yeah.
That had been this, the norm up until then, was revised. These are they've come to be known as the Queensberry rules, where the first championship took place in 1892. You know, the two sort of overlapped. It wasn't a direct switch. You know, some were resistant to the change, others embraced it. But this was you know, developed by a Scottish nobleman, the Marquis de Queensberry, who felt that, you know, the brutality inherent to bare knuckle fighting was really doing nothing, anything artistic for the game. And he made the switch, you know, he made some changes to the game, which overall slowly came to be embraced, some faster than others. The use of gloves, mainly for the protection of the hands, not the face. A limitation on rounds. The 10 count, the replacement of the, you know, the dirt patches in which bare knuckle fights would take place to the ring. Standard, you know, standardizing the size of the ring. The two coincidentally developed together. And in this way, you know, ultimately with the improvement of cinematic technique and the ability to project film to mass audiences, the first that was unveiled to the public was a about that's come to be known as the Corbett-Fitzsimmons fight. You know, this was extremely primitive in its way. Really very little tape survives, film survives. So this was just as, you know, if 1891 saw the development of what's come to be called the Veriscope, which is essentially those standing stanchions you might have seen in movies, or you might have actually seen some at fairs where you look, they're sort of like standing vista viewers, but you look down into them. Initially, they only allowed for 20-second running time. One of its inventors had a son who contrived the idea. As kinetoscope parlors started to open and became popular, people would only be willing to drop so many pennies in to watch 20 seconds, which at that time with the capacity of the Veriscope, to watch the same contortionists, acrobats, even cockfights. You know, that stuff got boring. But the son of one of the inventors had contrived the idea of doing prize fights. And that way, people, that would ensure that the pennies kept coming in. And so people would stay to the fight's finale. But by 1897, again, the projection of film allowed for mass audiences. We really consider the Corbett-Fitzsimmons fight of 1897 to be the first motion picture. And then from there, the first cinemas opened in 1902. And in 1905, there were over 3,000 throughout the US. So the two really developed concomitantly. And I think that was, you know, that was a spark of the interest. And rather than writing a whole book around that, I wanted to sort of trace the history of the 20th century through the two mediums. Yeah. And the best way, you know, I found to settle on it was by actually choosing individual films.
Right. What is like regarded as the first like narrative boxing film? Not footage of a fight that people like. I just think of like the Jack Johnson fight from 1919 or something like that. Or
that fight took place in 1910. If I'm not mistaken again. Yeah, that would have been in 1910 when he fought Jim Jeffries. Otherwise known as the Great White Hope, you know, the man who would take back the title for the white race. I mean, Jack Johnson, you know, and the racial component of the book subtitle figures in largely because, you know, it was quite a bad time for blacks. But they were, you know, one area that sort of leveled the playing field was boxing. When he took the title from, or rather, when he retained the title fighting Jim Jeffries, arguably Jack Johnson became what we could call the first movie star as a result of that fight, which caused a huge amount of consternation, race riots, the enacting of something called the Sims Act, where films were, it was forbidden for film to be transferred across state lines. And this in the interest of the less people who would see the film, the better.
Yeah.
And that actually remained the most popular film until 1915's KKK glorification film by D.W. Griffith, Birth of a Nation.
Right. I interrupted you, sorry. What do you think is the first like narrative
boxing film?
Yeah.
I'm gonna probably put that in the silent era. I would say probably Alfred Hitchcock's The Ring. I think, you know, I'm sure there's some listeners who may have some some other, there was also Buster Keaton in a film called The Battling Butler. And these are all pre-sound. So they're generally from the 20s, early 30s.
So you go through 20 each, like I said, each chapter about a different film. And I was just going to ask you about a couple in particular.
Sure.
So an early one, and I think it might even be the first chapter, the setup from 1949. How did that film reflect what was going on in the country and in the world at that time?
Well, the setup sort of epitomizes the film noir genre. By 1950, about a third of the entire country was living in cities. So we sort of see a shift to films based in the city and revolving around crime, the dangers of the city, because it had been, you know, it became so popular, you know, they had become so common and ubiquitous and anxiety producing. You know, a lot of people come back from the war, disillusioned, shell-shocked, whatever, and, you know, into these sort of this indifferent, the indifferent forces of the city, something dubbed in the early 19th century by an American psychiatrist named George M. Beard, the word being neurasthenia. Neurasthenia, if I'm pronouncing, I think that would be the pronunciation. He this essentially describes the alienation one feels surrounded in a large crowd, the alienating factor of the city, the anonymity. At the same time, you know, the crime rates were pretty high, and this was it was a big attraction, crime, to the public with films, early films from the early 30s, like The Public Enemy being a good example, Little Caesar, both of which were 1931, and then the aesthetic also came out of. Was derived very much from German expressionist films, mm-hmm. Metropolis, Nosferatu, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and improvements in film itself. But there was a huge fascination among the public with crime at that time. You know, it was entering the news. Gangsters, especially, you know, during Prohibition, their activities. As we see in a movie like The Public Enemy, and it actually served as the perfect vehicle for criminals to, you know, find other avenues of income, one of which was the control of fighters. Generally second generation immigrants were most likely to turn to fighting. Many were not so financially savvy. Many had, you know, didn't have a great grasp on the language itself. So this was, you know, they were seen as sort of money makers right off the bat, you know?
Yeah. What about another one I wanted to ask you about was Hitler's Kiss from 1955.
Well, that's a really interesting one. And actually for me, that was one of the most fascinating chapters to read up on, because, you know, Stanley Kubrick, of course, is a master. And, you know, I talked to Kubrick people, big fans, and I'd say just about none of them that I've talked to, and we're talking about 10 or so people, you know, they generally start with Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas, his film after Killer's Kiss. Killer's Kiss was made in 1955. And on the one hand, it's a very straightforward film noir. On the other hand, it is a real foreshadowing of auteur cinema, of which Kubrick was, you know, very much a progenitor. The chapter, while it does discuss the film itself, it goes a lot into the sort of guerrilla filmmaking that Kubrick employed, you know, handheld cameras, dubbing, post-dubbing sound. You know, he describes, he basically said he feels as if he went to film school, he wouldn't have made very good movies. He also said that he felt, you know, he bought some, he was originally a photographer for Look magazine, friends with Arthur Felix Ouija, the famous, the well-known crime scene photographer. And when Kubrick was just 17, he started working for what was then a popular magazine called Look, and became Look's New York correspondent. So it was, you know, started out as a photographer, made a did a feature on a boxer, and then a short film for RKO on the boxer, with maybe 15 minutes long, called the Day of the Fight. He had some interest in boxing, but I think he saw, like so many people in the, you know, at that age, during that period of time in that decade, boxing as a vehicle for, you know, the lone hero, like the cowboy, you know, that had come to, you know, with film noir, that cops and private eyes and boxers had come to replace, you know, the cowboys and, you know, the other kind of lone heroes, you know, bringing the stoic, morally conflicted hero to the city, you right. know, from the plains. But Kubrick had said he thought the quality of films he'd been seeing at that time, surprisingly, because there were, you know, there were so many good offerings. It was such a good decade. It was such a good period, but felt that what he was seeing was crap. And that thought, as a young man, I couldn't, you know, I wasn't quite sure how to make a film, but I knew whatever I made would be at least as good as what I'm seeing, if not better. And, you know, so it was, like I said, very... very much a guerrilla undertaking, and almost done single-handedly.
One a movie that's been on my list for years, and I still have not watched it for some reason, but I always wanted to, and I wanted to ask you about it, was, and it's in your book, is Fat City from 1972. Can you talk about your approach to that, like how you think that movie kind of reflects what the early 70s, what was going on then?
In its reflection of the early 70s, I think that would best be captured in the realism inherent to the film. It's not even, you know, when I say the seedy underside, I'm not referring to crime at all. I'm referring to what a, you know, hopeless sport boxing is for 99% of its practitioners who get into it. You know, it really, you know, to make it in the sport, like, you know, I compare it to acting, compare it to art, compare it to what you want. You know, the slimmest majority make it through. And I mean, first to answer your question, it's a John Huston film who, and he had switched away around that time in the late 60s from more grandiose epics. You know, he worked with Bogart a lot in his early days, and really the two of them, you know, in many ways, Huston helped Bogart's career a great deal, or maybe we can at least say they worked together very well. His first movie with the Maltese Falcon, John Huston. But from there, I think by the late 60s, he started to realize he didn't have to make epics or large, you know, he could make what we might refer to as slice of life films, often derived from books. To me, Fat City is sort of a work of distilled realism that we started to see in the 1970s. Very, very unglamorous, very slice of life. And that was something that he, you know, I would also put Robert Altman in that camp of, I mean, several directors, but just off the top of my head. You know, making what we might call small pictures, but very good. Fat City, I want to add too that, you know, it's the one film that's really, really about the losers in the sport and offers no hope, no promise of success on the part of anyone, boxers or the other characters. And, you know, so it's a beautiful film. It's a poignant film. It's a bleak film. It also seems to be from all the boxers, boxing writers, or people, you know, who just enjoy boxing film, to be their favorite, you know, because I think it hits closest to home for many people.
You think part of that one, and again, I haven't seen it, but from what you just said, do you think part of the kind of dead end, hopeless aspects of it, does that have something to do with like the country being in the middle of the Vietnam War at the time and it being unpopular and just general kind of disillusionment with the America at that time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. I think it's a really good point, Matt, that I think the early 70s, you know, many films were about generally males and sort of lost in a sort of haze, veterans or not, in a very difficult moment of history. You know, of course, you know, the chapter on Ali, which incidentally I thought was a crap film, but it's difficult to leave out, you know, if we're you know, if boxing's incorporated in the history of the book, which, you know, is really half the subject, as they overlap, you know, Muhammad Ali's not someone you can leave out when talking, you know, about Vietnam, particularly about civil rights and about the general social upheaval in the country. So yes, I think that's a really good point you make about uncertainty about where the country was heading, this notion of, you know, being mired, you know, individuals mired in this social zeitgeist, but also separate from it, you know, they're out in fairly rural California. It's not so rural now, it's gentrified, but it's always been a big boxing town. The author, Leonard Gardner, of the Source novel, whom I had the good fortune to meet and talk with, described Stockton, California, where it takes place, as a big boxing town that never produced a champion. And then to quote, in fact, it never produced anything like a champion, as he said. So, you know, it's very much about the losers, the, you know, whether they're fighting booze or relationships, you know, it's very much a book about the failures in the sport and how easy it is to slip out of it once you start.
Why do you think boxing movies they still get made a lot? And why do you think they're so popular, even though boxing isn't as big with the general public as it was years ago?
That's really the big question, isn't it? I think that's an excellent question, and one of the first things I thought about when I started out on the book. Now, certainly, you know, in boxing's heyday, and we can even put that, I think, through the 80s, you know, but particularly, you know, mid-century. But yes, let's move right through the 80s, because it was a great decade for boxing. Since then, you know, the sport has become been slowly, some experts would argue, in decline, that it's, you know, that it's just not as exciting. The rivalries aren't as interesting. The stylistically, the fighters are not as good as the old guard. You know, I don't want to get into that too much now, because, you know, opinions, you know, there's still really hardcore boxing fans out there, but nothing like it used to be when, you know, Jack Dempsey's face in the 20s was as recognizable as the president's, or, you know, why does the genre endure? I think that people still have a fascination, obviously, with violence. I mean, we look at it, you know, it's hard to come across the cover of a DVD that's not a kid's movie, where somebody's not holding a gun. You know, you watch TV, you watch movies, everybody's got guns. You know, people are attracted to violence. I think there's a certain, in the boxing film, it's sort of a mix of, you know, you get this catharsis of violence, but within more or less the confines of a safe space. You know, it's not violent in the sense of gore, people getting blown away. You know, they're not exactly action films. They're more, you know, I don't like to use the term character studies, because a lot of recent offerings, and I haven't, you know, I don't go to boxing films very, very much. There's a lot I have not seen in the last, you know, since writing the book. I, you know, I plan to, and then I just don't get around to it. And I've seen some really bad ones too, which, you know, is so, But there's still that interest in a kind of, you know, that comparison I made before with, you know, the detective or even the cowboy, a character who, you know, despite supporters of, you know, of any kind, managers, wives, girlfriends, you know, the general public, is ultimately alone in his struggle. And I think that's a template that was set very early on. I think it really exploded with Rocky, with the popularity of Rocky. I don't see, you know, as I worded it in the introduction, people like boxing film. They might not like boxing, but they like the idea of the cathartic violence. And so it's, you know, being able to see a film of boxing without all that boxing, as I put it.
So what do you think is the state of today's boxing overall? You said, you know, we talked about how it wasn't as popular as it used to be for sure. But what do you think of it overall? And do you think it could make a comeback and be as big as it once was?
Me, on my part, I generally don't watch contemporary boxing. Because I follow so many boxing people on Twitter, you know, I will know about the important fights and generally YouTube them a day or two later. I don't buy fights anymore. Have I been impressed? I prefer watching old fights. I think it still has legions of devotees, but nothing like the old days. I think the main concern is CTE, is brain damage right now. I mean, we hear a lot about that. We hear it with football. We hear it with boxing sparring, that the helmets, the headgear doesn't really do very much good. So I think, you know, it's under a great deal of scrutiny around that. I don't see that, you know, changing anytime too soon, but I think it's moving in that direction. And, you know, at this point, you know, boxing has slowly been made safer over the years. One example being, which is fairly arbitrary, in the 1980s, the you know, moving from 15 round fights to 12 rounds, things like that, you know, sort of little things to mollify a concerned public. At the same time, you know, I think the biggest threat right now to the sport itself is concern around dementia and, you know, what the old timers would call punch drunkenness. Yeah. So I see much of a future for it as a non, you know, as I said, I'm far from encyclopedic on the entire boxing subject. I know what I know. I know what I've studied. There are certain areas I find fascinating and do deep delves, but contemporarily speaking, I haven't been especially impressed with what I've seen lately. And some Twitter followers might be, you know, vehemently disagree with that. I respect that. But, you know, yes, as to the current state of boxing, you know, I don't see boxing making a comeback.
Yeah.
But, you know, having said that, there is MMA too, which should be under equal scrutiny, and yet it, you know, is at probably the peak of popularity right now, you know?
Yeah. Is there like an old fight that you go back and watch, that you've gone back and watched a bunch of times that you like to revisit?
Well, one of my favorite fights actually was from, I believe it was 2000. It was Vargas versus Trinidad. Mm-hmm. Almost went the distance. That's a fantastic fight. But, you know, in terms of older fights, I think I will always have an affection for the Ali, the Cassius Clay Williams, Cleveland Williams. I will also, you know, on the political spectrum, I think the both fights between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling, mm-hmm. Which sort of, you know, had the whole shadow of the Third Reich hanging over it, and a black man in, you know, defending America, you know, representing America. That those fights, especially the second being, you know, as brief as it was, a fantastic fight, they have so much social ramifications surrounding them, that to watch them is, you know, is quite, you know, it's exciting, and doesn't get less exciting with each viewing. Otherwise, then there are individual fighters I enjoy watching and will watch, though, you know, they might not fall under my, you know, under my favorite, more, you know, special fights. I mean, you know, then there are just classics like Hagler Hearns or something like that, which is, you know, just beautiful, beautiful boxing wars, you know, that were really exciting. And I think those are, you know, fights that are worth revisiting time and again. I never really get sick of them.
And if you had to pick one boxing film that you would say is your favorite of all time, what would it be?
I don't think any of my listeners or your listeners, our listeners, are going to agree with me. But for me, the most poignant is probably 1956, The Harder They Fall, with Humphrey Bogart, and the way it speaks to crime. It reflects a reality, you know, it's based on a much used and discarded heavyweight from Italy named Primo Carnera, who actually shows up in a number of chapters because he, you know, many pugs controlled under the mob you know, punch drunk, you know, fighters beginning to, you know, beginning to wane, you know, was such an inspiration for the film. So I, though Carnera did, you know, his brain, stayed clear, still he was the, you know, the inspiration for Requiem for a Heavyweight, according to Rod Serling, who wrote the screenplay. In any case, I have a soft spot for The Harder They Fall. Many, many people would not put that in their top five, but it was Bogart's last film, and I just thought his performance was excellent, you know?
Yeah.
The boxing itself, you know, somebody who watches boxing will always scrutinize the boxing as acted in films, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, you watch something like Rocky III and it's just absurd, you know. I mean, it's not boxing at all, but you know, and I don't think there was anything particularly impressive to the boxing in The Harder They Fall, but I also think some of the best boxing movies feature very little boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And what's more interesting is the mechanisms around which the fights, the people controlling the fights, the fighter themselves, you know, are operating, and the social circumstances surrounding them at that time.
Take the ribbon from your hair, shake it loose and let it fall, laying soft against my skin. Like the shadow on the wall, come and lay down by my side till the early morning light. All I'm taking is your time. Help me make the night. I don't care what's right or wrong, and I don't try to understand. Let the devil take tomorrow, 'cause tonight I yesterday is dead and gone, and tomorrow's out of sight. And it's bad to be alone. Help me make it through the night. I don't want to be alone. Help me